correspond with the hopes and wishes of the Pope and the people. The Fourth Crusade was diverted from Syria to Constantinople, and the conquest of the Greek or Roman Empire by the Latins will form the proper and important subject of the next chapter. In the fifth, 200,000 Franks were landed at the eastern mouth of the Nile. They reasonably hoped that Palestine must be subdued in Egypt, the seat and storehouse of the Sultan. And after a siege of 16 months, the Muslims deplored the loss of Damietta. But the Christian army was ruined by the pride and insolence of the legate Pelagius, who, in the Pope's name, assumed the character of general. The sickly Franks were encompassed by the waters of the Nile and the Oriental forces, and it was by the evacuation of Damietta that they obtained a safe retreat, some concessions for the pilgrims, and the tardy restitution of the doubtful relic of the true cross. The failure may in some measure be ascribed to the abuse and multiplication of the Crusades, which were preached at the same time against the pagans of Livonia, the Moors of Spain, the Albigeois of France, and the kings of Sicily of the imperial family. In these meritorious services, the volunteers might acquire a home, the same spiritual indulgence, and a larger measure of temporal rewards. And even the popes, in their zeal against a domestic enemy, were sometimes tempted to forget the distress of their Syrian brethren. From the last age of the Crusades, they derived the occasional command of an army and revenue, and some deep reasoners have suspected that the whole enterprise, from the first Synod of Placentia, was contrived and executed by the policy of Rome. The suspicion is not founded, either in nature or in fact. The successors of St. Peter appear to have followed, rather than guided, the impulse of manners and prejudice. Without much foresight of the seasons or cultivation of the soil, they gathered the ripe and spontaneous fruits of the superstition of the times. They gathered these fruits without toil or personal danger. In the Council of the Lateran, Innocent III declared an ambiguous resolution of animating the Crusaders by his example. But the pilot of the sacred vessel could not abandon the helm, nor was Palestine ever blessed with the presence of a Roman pontiff. The persons, the families, and estates of the pilgrims were under the immediate protection of the popes, and these spiritual patrons soon claimed the prerogative of directing their operations and enforcing, by commands and censures, the accomplishment of their vow. Frederick II, the grandson of Barbarossa, was successively the pupil, the enemy, and the victim of the Church. At the age of 21 years, and in obedience to his guardian, Innocent III, he assumed the cross. The same promise was repeated at his royal and imperial coronations, and his marriage with the heiress of Jerusalem forever bound him to defend the kingdom of his son Conrad. But as Frederick advanced in age and authority, he repented of the rash engagements of his youth. His liberal sense and knowledge taught him to despise the phantoms of superstition and the crowns of Asia. He no longer entertained the same reverence for the successors of Innocent, and his ambition was occupied by the restoration of the Italian monarchy from Sicily to the Alps. But the success of this project would have reduced the popes to their primitive simplicity, and after the delays and excuses of 12 years, they urged the emperor, with entreaties and threats, to fix the time and place of his departure for Palestine. In the harbors of Sicily and Apulia he prepared a fleet of 100 galleys, and of 100 vessels that were framed to transport and land 2,500 knights with their horses and attendants. His vassals of Naples and Germany formed a powerful army, and the number of English crusaders was magnified to 60,000 by the report of fame. But the inevitable or affected slowness of these mighty preparations consumed the strength and provisions of the more indigent pilgrims. The multitude was thinned by sickness and desertion, and the sultry summer of Calabria anticipated the mischiefs of a Syrian campaign. At length the emperor hoisted sail at Brundusium with a fleet and army of 40,000 men, but he kept the sea no more than 3 days, and his hasty retreat, which was ascribed by his friends to a grievous indisposition, was accused by his enemies as a voluntary and obstinate disobedience. For suspending his vow was Frederick excommunicated by Gregory the Ninth. For presuming the next year to accomplish his vow, he was again excommunicated by the same pope. While he served under the banner of the cross, a crusade was preached against him in Italy, and after his return he was compelled to ask pardon for the injuries which he had suffered. The clergy and military orders of Palestine were previously instructed to renounce his communion and dispute his commands. And in his own kingdom, the emperor was forced to consent that the orders of the camp should be issued in the name of God and of the Christian Republic. Frederick entered Jerusalem in triumph, and with his own hands, for no priest would perform the office, he took the crown from the altar of the Holy Sepulchre. But the patriarch cast an interdict on the church which his presence had profaned. And the knights of the hospital and temple informed the Sultan how easily he might be surprised and slain in his unguarded visit to the River Jordan. In such a state of fanaticism and faction, victory was hopeless and defense was difficult, but the conclusion of an advantageous peace may be imputed to the discord of the Mohammedans and their personal esteem for the character of Frederick. The enemy of the church is accused of maintaining with the miscreants an intercourse of hospitality and friendship unworthy of a Christian, of despising the barrenness of the land, and of indulging a profane thought that if Jehovah had seen the kingdom of Naples, he never would have selected Palestine for the inheritance of his chosen people. Yet Frederick obtained from the Sultan the restitution of Jerusalem, of Bethlehem and Nazareth, of Tyre and Sidon. The Latins were allowed to inhabit and fortify the city. An equal code of civil and religious freedom was ratified for the sectaries of Jesus and those of Mohammed. And while the former worshipped at the Holy Sepulchre, the latter might pray and preach in the mosque of the temple, from whence the prophet undertook his nocturnal journey to heaven. The clergy deplored this scandalous toleration, and the weaker Muslims were gradually expelled. But every rational object of the Crusades was accomplished without bloodshed. The churches were restored, the monasteries were replenished, and in the space of 15 years the Latins of Jerusalem exceeded the number of 6,000. This peace and prosperity, for which they were ungrateful to their benefactor, was terminated by the eruption of the strange and savage hordes of Carizmians. Flying from the arms of the Moguls, those shepherds of the Caspian rolled headlong on Syria, and the union of the Franks with the sultans of Aleppo, Hems, and Damascus was insufficient to stem the violence of the torrent. Whatever stood against them was cut off by the sword or dragged into captivity. The military orders were almost exterminated in a single battle, and in the pillage of the city, in the profanation of the Holy Sepulchre, the Latins confess and regret the modesty and discipline of the Turks and Saracens. Of the 7 Crusades, the last 2 were undertaken by Louis the Ninth, King of France, who lost his liberty in Egypt and his life on the coast of Africa. 28 years after his death he was canonized at Rome, and 65 miracles were readily found and solemnly attested to justify the claim of the royal saint. The voice of history renders a more honorable testimony that he united the virtues of a king, a hero, and a man, that his martial spirit was tempered by the love of private and public justice, and that Louis was the father of his people, the friend of his neighbors, and the terror of the infidels. Superstition alone, in all the extent of her baleful influence, corrupted his understanding and his heart. His devotion stooped to admire and imitate the begging friars of Francis and Dominic. He pursued with blind and cruel zeal the enemies of the faith, and the best of kings twice descended from his throne to seek the adventures of a spiritual knight-errant. A monkish historian would have been content to applaud the most despicable part of his character, but the noble and gallant Joinville, who shared the friendship and captivity of Louis, has traced with the pencil of nature the free portrait of his virtues as well as of his failings. From this intimate knowledge we may learn to suspect the political views of depressing their great vassals, which are so often imputed to the royal authors of the Crusades. Above all the princes of the Middle Ages, Louis the Ninth successfully labored to restore the prerogatives of the crown. But it was at home, and not in the East, that he acquired for himself and his posterity. His vow was the result of enthusiasm and sickness, and if he were the promoter, he was likewise the victim of his holy madness. For the invasion of Egypt, France was exhausted of her troops and treasures. He covered the Sea of Cyprus with 1,800 sails. The most modest enumeration amounts to 50,000 men, and if we might trust his own confession, as it is reported by Oriental vanity, he disembarked 9,500 horse and 130,000 foot, who performed their pilgrimage under the shadow of his power. In complete armor, the Oriflamme waving before him, Louis leaped foremost on the beach, and the strong city of Damietta, which had cost his predecessors a siege of 16 months, was abandoned on the first assault by the trembling Muslims. But Damietta was the first and the last of his conquests, and in the 5th and 6th Crusades, the same causes, almost on the same ground, were productive of similar calamities. After a ruinous delay which introduced into the camp the seeds of an epidemic disease, the Franks advanced from the seacoast towards the capital of Egypt and strove to surmount the unseasonable inundation of the Nile, which opposed their progress. Under the eye of their intrepid monarch, the barons and knights of France displayed their invincible contempt of danger and discipline. His brother, the Count of Artois, stormed with inconsiderate valor the town of Massoura, and the carrier pigeons announced to the inhabitants of Cairo that all was lost. But a soldier, who afterwards usurped the scepter, rallied the flying troops. The main body of the Christians was far behind the vanguard, and Artois was overpowered and slain. A shower of Greek fire was incessantly poured on the invaders. The Nile was commanded by the Egyptian galleys, the open country by the Arabs. All provisions were intercepted. Each day aggravated the sickness and famine, and about the same time a retreat was found to be necessary and impracticable. The Oriental writers confess that Louis might have escaped if he would have deserted his subjects. He was made prisoner, with the greatest part of his nobles. All who could not redeem their lives by service or ransom were inhumanly massacred, and the walls of Cairo were decorated with a circle of Christian heads. The King of France was loaded with chains, but the generous victor, a great-grandson of the brother of Saladin, sent a robe of honor to his royal captive, and his deliverance, with that of his soldiers, was obtained by the restitution of Damietta and the payment of 400,000 pieces of gold. In a soft and luxurious climate, the degenerate children of the companions of Nur ed-Din and Saladin were incapable of resisting the flower of European chivalry. They triumphed by the arms of their slaves, or Mamelukes, the hardy natives of Tartary, who at a tender age had been purchased of the Syrian merchants, and were educated in the camp and palace of the Sultan. But Egypt soon afforded a new example of the danger of Praetorian bands, and the rage of these ferocious animals who had been let loose on the strangers was provoked to devour their benefactor. In the pride of conquest, Turan Shaw, the last of his race, was murdered by his Mamelukes, and the most daring of the assassins entered the chamber of the captive king with drawn scimitars and their hands imbrued in the blood of their sultan. The firmness of Louis commanded their respect. Their avarice prevailed over cruelty and zeal. The treaty was accomplished, and the King of France, with the relics of his army, was permitted to embark for Palestine. He wasted 4 years within the walls of Acre, unable to visit Jerusalem and unwilling to return without glory to his native country. The memory of his defeat excited Louis, after 16 years of wisdom and repose, to undertake the 7th and last of the Crusades. His finances were restored, his kingdom was enlarged, a new generation of warriors had arisen, and he advanced with fresh confidence at the head of 6,000 horse and 30,000 foot. The loss of Antioch had provoked the enterprise. A wild hope of baptizing the king of Tunis tempted him to steer for the African coast, and the report of an immense treasure reconciled his troops to the delay of their voyage to the Holy Land. Instead of a proselyte, he found a siege. The French panted and died on the burning sands. St. Louis expired in his tent, and no sooner had he closed his eyes than his son and successor gave the signal of the retreat. "It is thus," says a lively writer, "that a Christian king died near the ruins of Carthage, waging war against the sectaries of Mohammed, in a land to which Dido had introduced the deities of Syria." A more unjust and absurd constitution cannot be devised than that which condemns the natives of a country to perpetual servitude under the arbitrary dominion of strangers and slaves. Yet such has been the state of Egypt above 500 years. The most illustrious sultans of the Bakharit and Borgite dynasties were themselves promoted from the Tartar and Circassian bands, and the 24 beys, or military chiefs, have ever been succeeded not by their sons, but by their servants. They produced the Great Charter of their liberties, the Treaty of Selim I with the Republic, and the Ottoman Emperor still accepts from Egypt a slight acknowledgement of tribute and subjection. With some breathing intervals of peace and order, the two dynasties are marked as a period of rapine and bloodshed, but their throne, however shaken, reposed on the two pillars of discipline and valor. Their sway extended over Egypt, Nubia, Arabia, and Syria. Their Mamelukes were multiplied from 800 to 25,000 horse, and their numbers were increased by a provincial militia of 107,000 foot and the occasional aid of 66,000 Arabs. Princes of such power and spirit could not long endure on their coast a hostile and independent nation, and if the ruin of the Franks was postponed about 40 years, they were indebted to the cares of an unsettled reign, to the invasion of the Mughals, and to the occasional aid of some warlike pilgrims. Among these, the English reader will observe the name of our first Edward, who assumed the cross in the lifetime of his father Henry. At the head of 1,000 soldiers, the future conqueror of Wales and Scotland delivered Acre from a siege, marched as far as Nazareth with an army of 9,000 men, emulated the fame of his uncle Richard, extorted by his valor a 10 years' truce, and escaped with a dangerous wound from the dagger of a fanatic assassin. Antioch, whose situation had been less exposed to the calamities of the Holy War, was finally occupied and ruined by Bodonkda, or Bibas, Sultan of Egypt and Syria. The Latin principality was extinguished, and the first seat of the Christian name was dispeopled by the slaughter of 17 and the captivity of 100,000 of her inhabitants. The maritime towns of Laodicea, Gabala, Tripoli, Berytus, Sidon, Tyre, and Jaffa, and the stronger castles of the Hospitallers and Templars successively fell, and the whole existence of the Franks was confined to the city and colony of St. John of Acre, which is sometimes described by the more classic title of Ptolemais. After the loss of Jerusalem, Acre, which is distant about 70 miles, became the metropolis of the Latin Christians, and was adorned with strong and stately buildings, with aqueducts, an artificial port, and a double wall. The population was increased by the incessant streams of pilgrims and fugitives. In the pauses of hostility, the trade of the East and West was attracted to this convenient station, and the market could offer the produce of every clime and the interpreters of every tongue. But in this complex of nations, every vice was propagated and practiced. Of all the disciples of Jesus and Mohammed, the male and female inhabitants of Acre were esteemed the most corrupt. Nor could the abuse of religion be corrected by the discipline of law. The city had many sovereigns and no government. The kings of Jerusalem and Cyprus, of the house of Lusignan, the princes of Antioch, the counts of Tripoli and Sidon, the great masters of the hospital, the temple and the Teutonic order, the republics of Venice, Genoa and Pisa, the Pope's legate, the kings of France and England, assumed an independent command. 17 tribunals exercised the power of life and death. Every criminal was protected in the adjacent quarter, and the perpetual jealousy of the nations often burst forth in acts of violence and blood. Some adventurers who disgraced the ensign of the cross compensated their want of pay by the plunder of the Mohammedan villages. 19 Syrian merchants who traded under the public faith were despoiled and hanged by the Christians. And the denial of satisfaction justified the arms of the Sultan Khalil. He marched against Acre at the head of 60,000 horse and 140,000 foot. His train of artillery, if I may use the word, was numerous and weighty. The separate timbers of a single engine were transported in 100 wagons. And the royal historian, Abu Feda, who served with the troops of Hamach, was himself a spectator of the Holy War. Whatever might be the vices of the Franks, their courage was rekindled by enthusiasm and despair. But they were torn by the discord of 17 chiefs, and overwhelmed on all sides by the powers of the Sultan. After a siege of 33 days, the double wall was forced by the Muslims. The principal tower yielded to their engines. The Mamelukes made a general assault. The city was stormed, and death or slavery was the lot of 60,000 Christians. The convent, or rather fortress, of the Templars resisted 3 days longer, but the great master was pierced with an arrow, and of 500 knights, only 10 were left alive. Less happy than the victims of the sword, if they lived to suffer on a scaffold in the unjust and cruel prescription of the whole order. The King of Jerusalem, the Patriarch, and the great master of the hospital effected their retreat to the shore. But the sea was rough, the vessels were insufficient, and great numbers of the fugitives were drowned before they could reach the Isle of Cyprus, which might comfort Lusignan for the loss of Palestine. By the command of the Sultan, the churches and fortifications of the Latin cities were demolished. A motive of avarice or fear still opened the Holy Sepulchre to some devout and defenseless pilgrims, and a mournful and solitary silence prevailed along the coast which had so long resounded with the world's debate. Chapter 60. Schism of the Greeks and Latins. State of Constantinople. Revolt of the Bulgarians. Isaac Angelus dethroned by his brother Alexius. Origin of the Fourth Crusade. Alliance of the French and Venetians with the son of Isaac. Their naval expedition to Constantinople. The two sieges and final conquest of the city by the Latins. The restoration of the Western Empire by Charlemagne was speedily followed by the separation of the Greek and Latin churches. A religious and national animosity still divides the two largest communions of the Christian Church, and the schism of Constantinople, by alienating her most useful allies and provoking her most dangerous enemies, has precipitated the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in the East. In the course of the present history, the aversion of the Greeks for the Latins has been often visible and conspicuous. It was originally derived from the disdain of servitude, inflamed after the time of Constantine by the pride of equality or dominion, and finally exasperated by the preference which their rebellious subjects had given to the alliance of the Franks. In every age, the Greeks were proud of their superiority in profane and religious knowledge. They had first received the light of Christianity. They had pronounced the decrees of the seven general councils. They alone possessed the language of scripture and philosophy. Nor should the barbarians, immersed in the darkness of the West, presume to argue on the high and mysterious questions of theological science. Those barbarians despised in their turn the restless and subtle levity of the Orientals, the authors of every heresy, and blessed their own simplicity, which was content to hold the tradition of the apostolic church. Yet in the 7th century, the synods of Spain, and afterwards of France, improved or corrupted the Nicene Creed on the mysterious subject of the third person of the Trinity. In the long controversies of the East, the nature and generation of the Christ had been scrupulously defined, and the well-known relation of Father and Son seemed to convey a faint image to the human mind. The idea of birth was less analogous to the Holy Spirit, who, instead of a divine gift or attribute, was considered by the Catholics as a substance, a person, a God. He was not begotten, but in the Orthodox style he proceeded. Did he proceed from the Father alone, perhaps by the Son, or from the Father and the Son? The first of these opinions was asserted by the Greeks, the second by the Latins, and the addition to the Nicene Creed of the word filioque kindled the flame of discord between the Oriental and the Gallic churches. In the origin of the disputes, the Roman pontiffs affected a character of neutrality and moderation. They condemned the innovation, but they acquiesced in the sentiment of their transalpine brethren. They seemed desirous of casting a veil of silence and charity over the superfluous research, and in the correspondence of Charlemagne and Leo III, the Pope assumes the liberality of a statesman, and the prince descends to the passions and prejudices of a priest. But the orthodoxy of Rome spontaneously obeyed the impulse of the temporal policy, and the filioque, which Leo wished to erase, was transcribed in the symbol and chanted in the liturgy of the Vatican. The Nicene and Athanasian creeds are held as the Catholic faith, without which none can be saved, and beyond papists and Protestants must now sustain and return the anathemas of the Greeks, who deny the procession of the Holy Ghost from the Son as well as from the Father. Such articles of faith are not susceptible of treaty, but the rules of discipline will vary in remote and independent churches, and the reason even of divines might allow that the difference is inevitable and harmless. The craft or superstition of Rome has imposed on her priests and deacons the rigid obligation of celibacy. Among the Greeks it is confined to the bishops. The loss is compensated by dignity or annihilated by age, and the parochial clergy, the papas, enjoy the conjugal society of the wives whom they have married before their entrance into holy orders. A question concerning the azims was fiercely debated in the 11th century, and the essence of the Eucharist was supposed in the East and West to depend on the use of leavened or unleavened bread. Shall I mention in a serious history the furious reproaches that were urged against the Latins, who for a long while remained on the defensive? They neglected to abstain, according to the apostolical decree, from things strangled and from blood. They fasted, a Jewish observance, on the Saturday of each week. During the first week of Lent, they permitted the use of milk and cheese. Their infirm monks were indulged in the taste of flesh, and animal grease was substituted for the want of vegetable oil. The holy chrism, or unction, in baptism was reserved to the episcopal order. The bishops, as the bridegrooms of their churches, were decorated with rings. Their priests shaved their faces and baptized by a single immersion. Such were the crimes which provoked the zeal of the patriarchs of Constantinople, and which were justified with equal zeal by the doctors of the Latin Church. Bigotry and national aversion are powerful magnifiers of every object of dispute, but the immediate cause of the schism of the Greeks may be traced in the emulation of the leading prelates, who maintained the supremacy of the old metropolis superior to all, and of the reigning capital inferior to none in the Christian world. About the middle of the 9th century, Photius, an ambitious layman, the captain of the guards and principal secretary, was promoted by merit and favor to the more desirable office of Patriarch of Constantinople. In science, even ecclesiastical science, he surpassed the clergy of the age, and the purity of his morals has never been impeached. But his ordination was hasty, his rise was irregular, and Ignatius, his abdicated predecessor, was yet supported by the public compassion and the obstinacy of his adherents. They appealed to the tribunal of Nicholas I, one of the proudest and most aspiring of the Roman pontiffs, who embraced the welcome opportunity of judging and condemning his rival of the East. Their quarrel was embittered by conflict of jurisdiction over the king and nation of the Bulgarians, nor was their recent conversion to Christianity of much avail to either prelate, unless he could number the proselytes among the subjects of his power. With the aid of his court, the Greek patriarch was victorious, but in the furious contest he deposed in his turn the successor of St. Peter and involved the Latin Church in the reproach of heresy and schism. Photius sacrificed the peace of the world to a short and precarious reign. He fell with his patron, the Caesar Bardas, and Basil the Macedonian performed an act of justice in the restoration of Ignatius, whose age and dignity had not been sufficiently respected. From his monastery, or prison, Photius solicited the favor of the emperor by pathetic complaints and artful flattery, and the eyes of his rival were scarcely closed when he was again restored to the throne of Constantinople. After the death of Basil, he experienced the vicissitudes of courts and the ingratitude of a royal pupil. The patriarch was again deposed, and in his last solitary hours, he might regret the freedom of a secular and studious life. In each revolution, the breath, the nod of the sovereign had been accepted by a submissive clergy, and a synod of 300 bishops was always prepared to hail the triumph or to stigmatize the fall of the holy or the execrable Photius. By a delusive promise of succor or reward, the popes were tempted to countenance these various proceedings, and the synods of Constantinople were ratified by their epistles or legates. But the court and the people, Ignatius and Photius, were equally adverse to their claims. Their ministers were insulted or imprisoned. The procession of the Holy Ghost was forgotten. Bulgaria was forever annexed to the Byzantine throne, and the schism was prolonged by their rigid censure of all the multiplied ordinations of an irregular patriarch. The darkness and corruption of the 10th century suspended the intercourse without reconciling the minds of the two nations. But when the Norman sword restored the churches of Apulia to the jurisdiction of Rome, the departing clock was warned by petulant epistle of the Greek patriarch to avoid and abhor the errors of the Latins. The rising majesty of Rome could no longer brook the insolence of a rebel, and Michael Carularius was excommunicated in the heart of Constantinople by the Pope's legates. Shaking the dust from their feet, they deposited on the altar of Santa Sophia a direful anathema, which enumerates the 7 mortal heresies of the Greeks, and devotes the guilty teachers and their unhappy sectaries to the eternal society of the devil and his angels. According to the emergencies of the church and state, a friendly correspondence was sometimes resumed. The language of charity and concord was sometimes affected. But the Greeks have never recanted their errors. The popes have never repealed their sentence. And from this thunderbolt we may date the consummation of the schism. It was enlarged by each ambitious step of the Roman pontiffs. The emperors blushed and trembled at the ignominious fate of their royal brethren of Germany, and the people were scandalized by the temporal power and the military life of the Latin clergy. The aversion of the Greeks and Latins was nourished and manifested in the three first expeditions to the Holy Land. Alexius Comnenus contrived the absence, at least, of the formidable pilgrims. His successors, Manuel and Isaac Angelus, conspired with the Muslims for the ruin of the greatest princes of the Franks, and their crooked and malignant policy was seconded by the active and voluntary obedience of every order of their subjects. Of this hostile temper, a large portion may doubtless be ascribed to the difference of language, dress, and manners, which severs and alienates the nations of the globe. The pride as well as the prudence of the sovereign was deeply wounded by the intrusion of foreign armies that claimed a right of traversing his dominions and passing under the walls of his capital. His subjects were insulted and plundered by the rude strangers of the West, and the hatred of the pusillanimous Greeks was sharpened by secret envy of the bold and pious enterprises of the Franks. But these profane causes of national enmity were fortified and inflamed by the venom of religious zeal. Instead of a kind embrace, a hospitable reception from their Christian brethren of the East, every tongue was taught to repeat the names of schismatic and heretic, more odious to an orthodoxia than those of pagan and infidel. Instead of being loved for the general conformity of faith and worship, they were abhorred for some rules of discipline, some questions of theology, in which themselves or their teachers might differ from the Oriental Church. In the crusade of Louis VII, the Greek clergy washed and purified the altars which had been defiled by the sacrifice of a French priest. The companions of Frederick Barbarossa deplore the injuries which they endured, both in word and deed, from the peculiar rancor of the bishops and monks. Their prayers and sermons excited the people against the impious barbarians, and the patriarch is accused of declaring that the faithful might obtain the redemption of all their sins by the extirpation of the schismatics. An enthusiast named Dorotheus alarmed the fears and restored the confidence of the emperor by prophetic assurance that the German heretic, after assaulting the gate of Blachernes, would be made a signal example of the divine vengeance. The passage of these mighty armies were rare and perilous events, but the Crusades introduced a frequent and familiar intercourse between the two nations, which enlarged their knowledge without abating their prejudices. The wealth and luxury of Constantinople demanded the productions of every climate. These imports were balanced by the art and labor of her numerous inhabitants. Her situation invites the commerce of the world, and in every period of her existence that commerce has been in the hands of foreigners. After the decline of Amalfi, the Venetians, Pisans, and Genoese introduced their factories and settlements into the capital of the empire. Their services were rewarded with honors and immunities. They acquired the possession of lands and houses. Their families were multiplied by marriages with the natives, and after the toleration of a Mohammedan mosque, it was impossible to interdict the churches of the Roman Rite. The two wives of Manuel Comnenus were of the race of the Franks, the first a sister-in-law of the Emperor Conrad, the second a daughter of the Prince of Antioch. He obtained for his son Alexius a daughter of Philip Augustus, King of France, and he bestowed his own daughter on a Marquis of Montferrat, who was educated and dignified in the palace of Constantinople. The Greek encountered the arms and aspired to the empire of the West. He esteemed the valor and trusted the fidelity of the Franks. Their military talents were unfitly recompensed by the lucrative offices of judges and treasurers. The policy of Manuel had solicited the alliance of the Pope, and the popular voice accused him of a partial bias to the nation and religion of the Latins. During his reign and that of his successor Alexius, they were exposed at Constantinople to the reproach of foreigners, heretics, and favorites, and this triple guilt was severely expiated in the tumult which announced the return and elevation of Andronicus. The people rose in arms. From the Asiatic shore, the tyrant dispatched his troops and galleys to assist the national revenge, and the hopeless resistance of the strangers served only to justify the rage and sharpen the daggers of the assassins. Neither age, nor sex, nor the ties of friendship or kindred could save the victims of national hatred and avarice and religious zeal. The Latins were slaughtered in their houses and in the streets. Their quarter was reduced to ashes. The clergy were burnt in their churches, and the sick in their hospitals, and some estimate may be formed of the slain from the clemency which sold above 4,000 Christians in perpetual slavery to the Turks. The priests and monks were the loudest and most active in the destruction of the schismatics, and they chanted a thanksgiving to the Lord when the head of a Roman cardinal, the Pope's legate, was severed from his body, fastened to the tail of a dog, and dragged with savage mockery through the city. The more diligent of the strangers had retreated on the first alarm to their vessels and escaped through the Hellespont from the scene of blood. In their flight, they burnt and ravaged 200 miles of the seacoast, inflicted a severe revenge on the guiltless subjects of the empire, marked the priests and monks as their peculiar enemies, and compensated by the accumulation of plunder the loss of their property and friends. On their return, they exposed to Italy and Europe the wealth and weakness, the perfidy and malice of the Greeks, whose vices were painted as the genuine characters of heresy and schism. The scruples of the first crusaders had neglected the fairest opportunities of securing, by the possession of Constantinople, the way to the Holy Land. Domestic revolution invited and almost compelled the French and Venetians to achieve the conquest of the Roman Empire of the East. In the series of the Byzantine princes, I have exhibited the hypocrisy and ambition, the tyranny and fall of Andronicus, the last male of the Comnenian family who reigned at Constantinople. The revolution which cast him headlong from the throne saved and exalted Isaac Angelus, who descended by the females from the same imperial dynasty. The successor of a second Nero might have found it an easy task to deserve the esteem and affection of his subjects. They sometimes had reason to regret the administration of Andronicus. The sound and vigorous mind of the tyrant was capable of discerning the connection between his own and the public interest, and while he was feared by all who could inspire him with fear, the unsuspected people and the remote provinces might bless the inexorable justice of their master. But his successor was vain and jealous of the supreme power which he wanted courage and abilities to exercise. His vices were pernicious. His virtues, if he possessed any virtues, were useless to mankind. And the Greeks, who imputed their calamities to his negligence, denied him the merit of any transient or accidental benefits of the times. Isaac slept on the throne, and was awakened only by the sound of pleasure. His vacant hours were amused by comedians and buffoons, and even to these buffoons the emperor was an object of contempt. His feasts and buildings exceeded the examples of royal luxury. The number of his eunuchs and domestics amounted to 20,000, and a daily sum of 4,000 pounds of silver would swell to 4 million sterling, the annual expense of his household and table. His poverty was relieved by oppression, and the public discontent was inflamed by equal abuses in the collection and the application of the revenue. while the Greeks numbered the days of their servitude, a flattering prophet, whom he rewarded with the dignity of patriarch, assured him of a long and victorious reign of 32 years, during which he should extend his sway to Mount Libanus and his conquests beyond the Euphrates. But his only step towards the accomplishment of the prediction was a splendid and scandalous embassy to Saladin, to demand the restitution of the Holy Sepulchre, and to propose an offensive and defensive league with the enemy of the Christian name. In these unworthy hands of Isaac and his brother, the remains of the Greek Empire crumbled into dust. The island of Cyprus, whose name excites the ideas of elegance and pleasure, was usurped by his namesake, a Comnenian prince. And by a strange concatenation of events, the sword of our English Richard bestowed that kingdom on the house of Lusignan, a rich compensation for the loss of Jerusalem. The honour of the monarchy and the safety of the capital were deeply wounded by the revolt of the Bulgarians and Wallachians. Since the victory of the second Basil, they had supported above 170 years the loose dominion of the Byzantine princes, but no effectual measures had been adopted to impose the yoke of laws and manners on these savage tribes. By the command of Isaac, their sole means of subsistence, their flocks and herds, were driven away to contribute towards the pomp of the royal nuptials. And their fierce warriors were exasperated by the denial of equal rank and pay in the military service. Peter and Asan, two powerful chiefs of the race of the ancient kings, asserted their own rights and the national freedom. Their demonic impostors proclaimed to the crowd that their glorious patron, Saint Demetrius, had forever deserted the cause of the Greeks, and the conflagration spread from the banks of the Danube to the hills of Macedonia and Thrace. After some faint efforts, Isaac Angelus and his brother acquiesced in their independence, and the imperial troops were soon discouraged by the bones of their fellow soldiers that were scattered along the passes of Mount Hemus. By the arms and policy of John, or Joannikes, the second kingdom of Bulgaria was firmly established. The subtle barbarian sent an embassy to Innocent III to acknowledge himself a genuine son of Rome in descent and religion, and humbly received from the Pope the license of coining money, the royal title, and a Latin archbishop or patriarch. The Vatican exulted in the spiritual conquest of Bulgaria, the first object of the schism, and if the Greeks could have preserved the prerogatives of the Church, they would gladly have resigned the rights of the monarchy. The Bulgarians were malicious enough to pray for the long life of Isaac Angelus, the surest pledge of their freedom and prosperity. Yet their chiefs could involve in the same indiscriminate contempt the family and nation of the emperor. In all the Greeks, said Asan to his troops, the same climate and character and education will be productive of the same fruits. Behold my lance, continued the warrior, and the long streamers that float in the wind. They differ only in color. They are formed of the same silk and fashioned by the same workman. Nor has the stripe that is stained in purple any superior price or value above its fellows. Several of these candidates for the purple successively rose and fell under the empire of Isaac. A general who had repelled the fleets of Sicily was driven to revolt and ruin by the ingratitude of the prince, and his luxurious repose was disturbed by secret conspiracies and popular insurrections. The emperor was saved by accident, or the merit of his servants. He was at length oppressed by an ambitious brother, who, for the hope of a precarious diadem, forgot the obligations of nature, of loyalty, and of friendship. While Isaac, in the Thracian valleys, pursued the idle and solitary pleasures of the chase, his brother, Alexius Angelus, was invested with the purple by the unanimous suffrage of the camp. The capital and the clergy subscribed to their choice, and the vanity of the new sovereign rejected the name of his fathers for the lofty and royal appellation of the Comnenian race. On the despicable character of Isaac I have exhausted the language of contempt, and can only add that in a reign of 8 years, the baser Alexius was supported by the masculine vices of his wife Euphrosyne. The first intelligence of his fall was conveyed to the late emperor by the hostile aspect and pursuit of the guards, no longer his own. He fled before them above 50 miles, as far as Stagira in Macedonia. But the fugitive, without an object or a follower, was arrested, brought back to Constantinople, deprived of his eyes, and confined in a lonesome tower on a scanty allowance of bread and water. At the moment of the revolution, his son Alexius, whom he educated in the hope of empire, was 12 years of age. He was spared by the usurper and reduced to attend his triumph, both in peace and war. But as the army was encamped on the seashore, an Italian vessel facilitated the escape of the royal youth, and in the disguise of a common sailor, he eluded the search of his enemies, passed the Hellespont, and found a secure refuge in the Isle of Sicily. After saluting the threshold of the apostles and imploring the protection of Pope Innocent III, Alexius accepted the kind invitation of his sister Irene, the wife of Philip of Swabia, king of the Romans. But in his passage through Italy, he heard that the flower of Western chivalry was assembled at Venice for the deliverance of the Holy Land, and a ray of hope was kindled in his bosom that their invincible swords might be employed in his father's restoration. About 10 or 12 years after the loss of Jerusalem, the nobles of France were again summoned to the Holy War by the voice of a third prophet, less extravagant perhaps than Peter the Hermit, but far below Saint Bernard in the merit of an orator and a statesman. An illiterate priest of the neighborhood of Paris, Fulk of Neuilly, forsook his parochial duty to assume the more flattering character of a popular and itinerant missionary. The fame of his sanctity and miracles was spread over the land. He declaimed with severity and vehemence against the vices of the age, and his sermons, which he preached in the streets of Paris, converted the robbers, the usurers, the prostitutes, and even the doctors and scholars of the university. No sooner did Innocent III ascend the chair of St. Peter than he proclaimed in Italy, Germany, and France the obligation of a new crusade. The eloquent pontiff described the ruin of Jerusalem, the triumph of the pagans, and the shame of Christendom. His liberality proposed the redemption of sins, a plenary indulgence to all who should serve in Palestine, either a year in person or 2 years by a substitute. And among his legates and orators, who blew the sacred trumpet, Fulk of Neuilly was the loudest and most successful. The situation of the principal monarchs was averse to the pious summons. The Emperor Frederick II was a child, and his kingdom of Germany was disputed by the rival houses of Brunswick and Swabia, the memorable factions of the Guelphs and Ghibellines. Philip Augustus of France had performed, and could not be persuaded to renew, the perilous vow. But as he was not less ambitious of praise than of power, he cheerfully instituted a perpetual fund for the defense of the Holy Land. Richard of England was satiated with the glory and misfortunes of his first adventure, and he presumed to deride the exhortations of Fulk of Neuilly, who was not abashed in the presence of kings. "You advise me," said Plantagenet, "to dismiss my 3 daughters, pride, avarice, and incontinence. I bequeath them to the most deserving, my pride to the Knights Templars, my avarice to the monks of Sisto, and my incontinence to the prelates." But the preacher was heard and obeyed by the great vassals, the princes of the Second Order, and Theobald, or Thibaut, Count of Champagne, was the foremost in the holy race. The valiant youth, at the age of 22 years, was encouraged by the domestic examples of his father, who marched in the Second Crusade, and of his elder brother, who had ended his days in Palestine with the title of King of Jerusalem. 2,200 knights owed service and homage to his peerage. The nobles of Champagne excelled in all the exercises of war, and by his marriage with the heiress of Navarre, Thibault could draw a band of hardy Gascons from either side of the Pyrenean mountains. His companion in arms was Louis, Count of Blois and Chartres. Like himself of regal lineage, for both the princes were nephews, at the same time, of the kings of France and England. In a crowd of prelates and barons who imitated their zeal, I distinguished the birth and merit of Matthew of Montmorency, the famous Simon of Montfort, the scourge of the Albigeois, and a valiant noble, Geoffrey of Villehardouin, Marshal of Champagne, who has condescended in the rude idiom of his age and country to write or dictate an original narrative of the councils and actions in which he bore a memorable part. At the same time, Baldwin, Count of Flanders, who had married the sister of Thibault, assumed the cross at Bruges with his brother Henry and the principal knights and citizens of that rich and industrious province. The vow, which the chiefs had pronounced in churches, they ratified in tournaments. The operations of the war were debated in full and frequent assemblies, and it was resolved to seek the deliverance of Palestine in Egypt, a country, since Saladin's death, which was almost ruined by famine and civil war. But the fate of so many royal armies displayed the toils and perils of a land expedition, and if the Flemings dwelt along the ocean, the French barons were destitute of ships and ignorant of navigation. They embraced the wise resolution of choosing 6 deputies or representatives, of whom Villehardouin was one, with a discretionary trust to direct the motions and to pledge the faith of the whole confederacy. The maritime states of Italy were alone possessed of the means of transporting the holy warriors with their arms and horses, and the 6 deputies proceeded to Venice to solicit, on motives of piety or interest, the aid of that powerful republic. In the invasion of Italy by Attila, I have mentioned the flight of the Venetians from the fallen cities of the continent, and their obscure shelter in the chain of islands that line the extremity of the Adriatic Gulf. In the midst of the waters, free, indigent, laborious, and inaccessible, they gradually coalesced into a republic. The first foundations of Venice were laid in the island of Rialto, and the annual election of the 12 tribunes was superseded by the permanent office of a duke or doge. On the verge of the 2 empires, the Venetians exult in the belief of primitive and perpetual independence. Against the Latins, their antique freedom has been asserted by the sword, and may be justified by the pen. Charlemagne himself resigned all claims of sovereignty to the islands of the Adriatic Gulf. His son Pepin was repulsed in the attacks of the lagunas, or canals, too deep for the cavalry and too shallow for the vessels, and in every age, under the German Caesars, the lands of the Republic have been clearly distinguished from the Kingdom of Italy. But the inhabitants of Venice were considered by themselves, by strangers, and by their sovereigns as an inalienable portion of the Greek Empire. In the 9th and 10th centuries, the proofs of their subjection are numerous and unquestionable, and the vain titles, the servile honors of the Byzantine court, so ambitiously solicited by their dukes, would have degraded the magistrates of a free people. But the bands of this dependence, which was never absolute or rigid, were imperceptibly relaxed by the ambition of Venice and the weakness of Constantinople. Obedience was softened into respect, privilege ripened into prerogative, and the freedom of domestic government was fortified by the independence of foreign dominion. The maritime cities of Istria and Dalmatia bowed to the sovereigns of the Adriatic, and when they armed against the Normans in the cause of Alexius, the emperor applied not to the duty of his subjects, but to the gratitude and generosity of his faithful allies. The sea was their patrimony. The western parts of the Mediterranean, from Tuscany to Gibraltar, were indeed abandoned to their rivals of Pisa and Genoa. But the Venetians acquired an early and lucrative share of the commerce of Greece and Egypt. Their riches increased with the increasing demand of Europe. Their manufactures of silk and glass, perhaps the institution of their bank, are of high antiquity, and they enjoyed the fruits of their industry and the magnificence of public and private life. To assert her flag, to avenge her injuries, to protect the freedom of navigation, the Republic could launch and man a fleet of 100 galleys, and the Greeks, the Saracens, and the Normans were encountered by her naval arms. The Franks of Syria were assisted by the Venetians in the reduction of the sea coast, but their zeal was neither blind nor disinterested, and in the conquest of Tyre they shared the sovereignty of a city, the first seat of the commerce of the world. The policy of Venice was marked by the avarice of a trading and the insolence of a maritime power. Yet her ambition was prudent, nor did she often forget that if armed galleys were the effect and safeguard, merchant vessels were the cause and supply of her greatness. In her religion she avoided the schisms of the Greeks without yielding a servile obedience to the Roman pontiff, and a free intercourse with the infidels of every clime appears to have allayed betimes the fever of superstition. Her primitive government was a loose mixture of democracy and monarchy. The Doge was elected by the votes of the General Assembly. As long as he was popular and successful, he reigned with the pomp and authority of a prince. But in the frequent revolutions of the state, he was deposed, or banished, or slain by the justice or injustice of the multitude. The 12th century produced the first rudiments of the wise and jealous aristocracy, which has reduced the Doge to a pageant, and the people to a cipher. When the 6 ambassadors of the French pilgrims arrived at Venice, they were hospitably entertained in the palace of St. Mark by the reigning duke. His name was Henry Dandolo, and he shone in the last period of human life as one of the most illustrious characters of the times. Under the weight of years, and after the loss of his eyes, Dandolo retained a sound understanding and a manly courage. The spirit of a hero ambitious to signalize his reign by some memorable exploits, and the wisdom of a patriot anxious to build his fame on the glory and advantage of his country. He praised the bold enthusiasm and liberal confidence of the barons and their deputies. In such a cause and with such associates, he should aspire, were he a private man, to terminate his life. But he was the servant of the Republic, and some delay was requisite to consult on this arduous business the judgment of his colleagues. The proposal of the French was first debated by the 6 sages who had been recently appointed to control the administration of the Doge. It was next disclosed to the 40 members of the Council of State, and finally communicated to the Legislative Assembly of 450 representatives, who were annually chosen in the 6 quarters of the city. In peace and war, the Doge was still the chief of the Republic. His legal authority was supported by the personal reputation of Dandolo. His arguments of public interest were balanced and approved, and he was authorized to inform the ambassadors of the following conditions of the treaty. It was proposed that the crusaders should assemble at Venice on the feast of St. John of the ensuing year, that flat-bottomed vessels should be prepared for 4,500 horses and 9,000 squires, with a number of ships sufficient for the embarkation of 4,500 knights and 20,000 foot, that during a term of 9 months they should be supplied with provisions and transported to whatsoever coast the service of God and Christendom should require, and that the Republic should join the armament with a squadron of 50 galleys. It was required that the pilgrims should pay, before their departure, a sum of 85,000 marks of silver, and that all conquests, by sea and land, should be equally divided between the confederates. The terms were hard, but the emergency was pressing, and the French barons were not less profuse of money than of blood. A general assembly was convened to ratify the treaty. The stately chapel and place of St. Mark were filled with 10,000 citizens, and the noble deputies were taught a new lesson of humbling themselves before the majesty of the people. "Illustrious Venetians," said the Marshal of Champagne, "we are sent by the greatest and most powerful barons of France to implore the aid of the masters of the sea for the deliverance of Jerusalem. They have enjoined us to fall prostrate at your feet, nor will we rise from the ground till you have promised to avenge with us the injuries of Christ." The eloquence of their words and tears, their martial aspect and suppliant attitude, were applauded by a universal shout. As it were, says Geoffrey, by the sound of an earthquake. The venerable Doge ascended the pulpit to urge their request by those motives of honor and virtue which alone can be offered to a popular assembly. The treaty was transcribed on parchment, attested with oaths and seals, mutually accepted by the weeping and joyful representatives of France and Venice, and dispatched to Rome for the approbation of Pope Innocent III. 2,000 marks were borrowed of the merchants for the first expenses of the armament. Of the 6 deputies, 2 repassed the Alps to announce their success, while their 4 companions made a fruitless trial of the zeal and emulation of the republics of Genoa and Pisa. The execution of the treaty was still opposed by unforeseen difficulties and delays. The marshal, on his return to Troyes, was embraced and approved by Thibault, Count of Champagne, who had been unanimously chosen general of the Confederates. But the health of that valiant youth already declined, and soon became hopeless, and he deplored the untimely fate which condemned him to expire not in a field of battle, but on a bed of sickness. To his brave and numerous vassals the dying prince distributed his treasures. They swore in his presence to accomplish his vow and their own. But some there were, says the marshal, who accepted his gifts and forfeited their words. The more resolute champions of the cross held a parliament at Soissons for the election of a new general. But such was the incapacity, or jealousy, or reluctance of the princes of France, that none could be found both able and willing to assume the conduct of the enterprise. They acquiesced in the choice of a stranger, of Boniface, Marquis of Montferrat, descended of a race of heroes, and himself of conspicuous fame in the wars and negotiations of the times. Nor could the piety or ambition of the Italian chief decline this honorable invitation. After visiting the French court, where he was received as a friend and kinsman, the Marquis, in the church of Soissons, was invested with the cross of a pilgrim and the staff of a general, and immediately repassed the Alps to prepare for the distant expedition of the East. About the festival of the Pentecost, he displayed his banner and marched towards Venice at the head of the Italians. He was preceded or followed by the counts of Flanders and Blois, and the most respectable barons of France, and their numbers were swelled by the pilgrims of Germany, whose object and motives were similar to their own. The Venetians had fulfilled and even surpassed their engagements. Stables were constructed for the horses, and barracks for the troops. The magazines were abundantly replenished with forage and provisions, and the fleet of transports, ships, and galleys